You are listening to the War on the Rocks podcast on strategy, defense, and foreign affairs. My name is Ryan Evans. I'm the editor-in-chief of War on the Rocks. In this special episode of our podcast, we feature a panel that I moderated at a major conference at Johns Hopkins SAIS called Pakistan Beyond 70, The Long View. 7 decades after its independence, Pakistan remains deeply marked by its internal contradictions and contested regional relationships. And yet it has shown a surprising social and political resilience that has bellied the bleak forecasts of many of its critics. Building on the retrospective events that marked Pakistan's 70th year, this conference, which was jointly organized, as I mentioned, by SAIS, but also the Lahore University of Management Sciences in Pakistan, brought together leading scholars and policy experts for a clear-eyed exploration of the dynamics that are likely to shape Pakistan's political stability, its economic health, its place in the wider Eurasian political economy, and its relationship with the United States and its neighbors over the coming decades. The panel I moderated was focused on regional realignments, Pakistan, its neighbors, and the great powers. It featured a pretty impressive panel of experts. Let me run through them real quickly for you right now. First up was Dr. Samil Lalwani, Senior Associate for Asia Strategy and Co-Director for South Asia at the Stimson Center. Dr. Tanvi Madan, a Fellow of Foreign Policy at the Brookings Institution and the Director of their India Project. Dr. Daniel Markey, Senior Research Professor and Academic Director of the Masters of Arts in Global Policy Program at Johns Hopkins SAIS. Dr. Olga Oliker, Senior Advisor and Director of the Russia and Eurasia Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. And last but certainly not least, from Pakistan, Dr. Rasul Baksh Rais, Professor of Political Science at LUMS. We're recording this as well as part of the War on the Rocks podcast series, which if you don't listen to, you should be. And if you do listen to, you know that we usually record these over drinks. We're going to stick with non-alcoholic for this episode, where we'll wait for later for the actual drinks. But I thought I'd kick it off. We'll have a bit of a discussion, and then later on we'll turn to you all for questions, because there is truly a wealth of experience in this room, not just on the panel, but in the audience as well. So first, I'd like to kick it over to Samir. You know, what are we're talking about regional realignments. What are we actually talking about here? What are the trend lines that suggest that strategic competition in this region, South Asia, is intensifying?
So I think there's a number of trend lines, many of which are obvious, but it's just worth stating them and laying them out quickly. The first is the most sort of prominent one is military modernization and potentially what we call arms racing that seems to be taking place in this region of Southern Asia, not simply between India and Pakistan, between India and China, and certainly in part sort of precipitated by Chinese efforts to modernize to offset U.S. advantages both in the Pacific and the Indian Ocean. And this takes the form of nuclear modernization, delivery systems. There's been a series of tests by India, Pakistan, and China of advanced missile systems. Conventional strike platforms, the adoption of the military technical revolution has started to hit this region pretty hard. So improvements in precision, speed, standoff capabilities, ISR. And then that's probably fueling some elements of changes in doctrine in terms of how the states in the region think about doctrine. And then there's probably worth mentioning a couple other things. You're seeing, even though alliances aren't as intense in this region, you have alignments that are forming, right? So the U.S.-India relationship is intensifying or strengthening alignment, even if it's not an alliance. Similarly with China and Pakistan, a harder type of alignment than previously seen. And the role of China in the region is also one that I think we'll get into in this discussion. But I see it as playing a much larger role in the last few years than it has maybe in the past few decades. It's not just an arms provider, but it's also intensifying its co-production and sort of higher technology sharing, particularly with Pakistan. And it's got greater economic investments in the region. It's much more exposed in terms of its economic investments, particularly in Pakistan, but the OBOR project writ large makes it more exposed in the region. And then there's a real credible possibility that a lot of its investments are dual use and potentially going to be future basing or future force presence in the region. And all this seems to sort of undergird what I would say is, a lot of power transitions, a lot of regional power transitions. We think a lot about the great power transition taking place on the global stage, but there are a lot of regional power transitions that are just as consequential in a number of ways and impacting the probability of the thing that a lot of us think about, which is the probability of war. So there's a lot higher risk of information and credibility problems that get enhanced with these transitions. A lot of room for false optimism, which is another sort of key driver for war, both false optimism for victory in war, but also for escalation control, particularly with advanced modernization of military systems. This is a region which I would say, you know, to put it politely, has a history of poor strategic assessment from all parties. And then it becomes most consequential because we have a lot of nuclear powers in the region. India, China, Pakistan, the United States all operate in this theater, potentially with nuclear systems at sea or at some point in the future at sea. And that makes for, you know, sort of a dangerous mix. So I see all that as sort of feeding this intensification of the risks in the region.
Tanvi, another sort of big picture question. We're hearing a lot about something called the Quad lately. You've written about it extensively at War on the Rocks and elsewhere. What is the Quad? How do the four countries that make it up envision it differently? And is it possible that the Quad is perhaps another example of what Samir just described as part of a history of poor strategic assessments?
So I think the Quad is this mythical creature that comes up every decade. And it is what you want it to be.
Like the cicadas, sort of. But not,
like the cicadas, yes. It comes in a swarm and then it disappears till you see it again. It was something that was formed about a decade ago. And it was really just a meeting, a grouping of four countries, Australia, India, Japan, and the U.S. that came together. And this was actually came together in a post-tsunami coordination a group that eventually, you know, I don't remember who called it the Quad to start with, but it came up and then it's been revived recently when the four countries met. This time it is much more, though they'll all say it's not about China. Let's put it another way. If each country involved didn't have concerns about managing China's rise, uncertainty about Chinese intentions, some who called it aggressive behavior, some have called it its assertive behavior. If these concerns didn't exist, I doubt the Quad would have met. So it is this grouping. We don't know where it goes. It is, at the moment, it is a group that has met at kind of assistant secretary level on the U.S. side to discuss the rules-based order in the region and how to maintain it. But there have been a range of issues that they talked about, everything from North Korea to regional connectivity to maritime security. So I think some of it is, it should be put in perspective. It is not, it should not be conflated, for example, as another piece in War on the Rocks by Lindsay Ford recently said, it should not be conflated with the administration's entire free and open Indo-Pacific strategy. But it is a grouping of four countries that clearly have some concerns and are sharing perceptions and perhaps in the future acting together on some of them.
Lindsay, I think, coined a great term in that article, the non-Quad Squad, which I enjoyed. Another big regional shift, Dan, looking at Pakistan, one of the things that we're hearing a lot about is CPEC, the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor. First, could you just explain what it is? I know a lot of people in this room probably know that already, but just sort of give us the basics. But then, do you think that Pakistan's embrace of CPEC is motivated more by economic or strategic aims? And is it possible to even disentangle those two things?
Great. I don't think... Is my mic working? Okay. The light is not working, but the mic is working, so that's the important part. So, in a nutshell, CPEC, the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor, is probably the biggest and most exciting thing that's happened to Pakistan in the last decade plus. It is expressed by Pakistanis and Chinese at the leadership level as a major injection of Chinese capital, of investment, into Pakistan in the form of a range of infrastructure projects, most notably and most extensively, at least at the outset, in the energy sector, where Pakistan has really been lagging for some time and where the demand has been most acute, but also extending into transportation infrastructure and the kind of the bumper sticker or the thing that jumps out off the page has often been Gwadar Port, which I think Samir already mentioned, as a potential opportunity for the Chinese to have a port on the Arabian Sea. And what distinguishes it from, say, a Djibouti base or something like that is the possibility of overland access via Western China through Pakistan directly to the sea. And this is something that is strategically relevant, maybe less so than some of its most active proponents would suggest, but still relevant nonetheless. Now, is it being, you asked whether it's being pursued for economic or strategic reasons, and the answer is yes. So economically, Pakistan has found itself, particularly in the aftermath of its on-again, off-again relationship with the United States and the deterioration of U.S. efforts to provide support and assistance to Pakistan, Pakistan has found itself with too few friends and too little foreign direct investment. And so the Chinese investment is really perceived in many quarters in Pakistan as an opportunity to really jumpstart that or kickstart it in a very positive way. The problem is that that's not being done, and I can get on at length and I won't, but it's not being done in a very reform-oriented way that is, in my estimate, most likely to lead to long-term and sustainable economic growth and development in Pakistan and encourage other outside investors, including the United States. Instead, it's been done in a more narrow way, and this gets to the strategic side. Pakistan obviously sees huge value in a big Chinese friend and brother backing it up on all manner of things, not least its relationship with the United States, but perhaps most importantly and acutely from a Pakistani perspective in terms of its relationship with India. I'll leave it there.
That was great. Thank you. Olga, Russia is obviously a major player in Southern Asia. Is the Russian approach to Southern Asia, particularly its burgeoning ties with Pakistan, specifically something driven by opportunism or a larger geopolitical vision? And again, is it possible to separate those two things, especially when it comes to Russia?
Right. Well, I mean, I would say most of what Russia does is opportunism driven by a larger strategic vision. excuse me. I wouldn't call Russia a major player in South Asia quite yet. It's a player, but compared to China and the United States, it's comparatively minor in the great power scheme of things. It's had a longstanding relationship with India, which it inherited from the Soviet Union, but most of what's left of that is an arms sales portfolio. Now, it's a big arms sales portfolio. India is Russia's top buyer, and Russia provides something like 70% of India's weapons. But efforts to make it broader, efforts to get more real trade, efforts to get energy cooperation up have been sporadic and not very easy to scale up. So Russia's interest in Pakistan is a new wrinkle in all of this. It's something that's really emerged since 2014, though there was some talk of it back around 2012. And so far, it's really about defense. It's selling helicopters and jets and some military exercises. And I would argue that it fits into what Samir was talking about in the context of this is geostrategic competition. Why is Russia suddenly interested in Pakistan? Well, there's an opening because the U.S.-Pakistan relationship has deteriorated. And in a lot of ways, you know, I would say that Russia thinks of the United States after the Cold War as having picked up some of the candy that it dropped and started to eat it instead of giving it back, right, in the form of the Warsaw Pact countries and several former Soviet countries. I would say Russia's trying to pick up bits of candy that the Americans are dropping along the way. So if an American relationship starts going badly, well, there's an opportunity for Russia to develop it. On the other hand, they don't want to jeopardize their relationship with India. So you get this interesting push-pull that they want to pursue it, but they're going to be careful about it. And so far, they're succeeding.
Thank you for that. That was great. Rasul, one of the region's enduring conflicts, of course, is in Afghanistan. What is Pakistan's vision for sustaining influence in Afghanistan over the next 5 to 10 years? What are the sort of debates that you hear going on in Pakistan about this?
I think the focal point of Pakistan's Afghan policy is that that it must retain a good degree of influence in a positive way. The reason is that Afghanistan has been used by adversarial powers to Pakistan as a base. It started with Soviet influence, and we know the history. I don't want to go into the detail. It was deep penetration of that very weak state, and finally they took it over, intervened, and imposed a very costly conflict on that state. Our response to that was U.S. and Pakistan and Western allies was that we have to evict the Soviet Union. But then the end result of all that was destruction of the Afghan state. Afghan society and Afghan people. So we had into a 40 years long war, and United States war is about 16th or 17th year. We are nowhere close to securing Afghanistan, stabilizing it, bringing about peace and stability and order in that country. Peace and stability and order is a major concern. But Pakistan can be one of the influences. Pakistan is one of, I would say, one of the weakest or weaker actors. There are non-state actors like the rise of Taliban. There is Russian involvement. There is Iranian involvement. United States and its allies is there. India is deepening its influence and involvement in Afghanistan. In such a climate where there is a very intense strategic competition, Pakistan remains fixed on that line, and rightly so, that at least Afghanistan should not be used as a backyard. Pakistan's strategic backyard should not be used by any power to destabilize Balochistan or other parts of the country. And we have evidence that India has been using the border regions of Afghanistan and also border regions of Iran to aid and assist and give sanctuaries to some elements of the TTP, but most notably to the Baloch militants, the Baloch nationalists. So our vision is a peaceful settlement between Taliban and the government. And without that political settlement and broader national reconciliation in Afghanistan, we cannot bring this war to the end. But the experience shows, and I think that should be an experience registered in the United States as well, that war is not a solution. That is one of the debates. The second one is that there must be a negotiated settlement. But then, what kind of settlement? Which is primarily from our point of view and looking at history, and we have a very bad experience in the sense that all the debris of the Afghan conflict over the past 40 years has fallen on Pakistan and Pakistani society. So we think that we can bring the Taliban and the Afghans to the negotiating table, but it must be Afghan-owned, Afghan-led process. Any outside influence and intrusion we have seen in the past has not really been long-lasting as far as a peace and order in Afghanistan is concerned. So our vision is to also, I think, believe that Pakistan cannot really settle this country. Even the United States cannot settle this country back into order. It requires regional consensus as well as much deeper and a positive involvement of international community. But the center point of settling Afghanistan into a peaceful neighborhood and a peaceful regional country is that the major powers have to take initiative. We had started a good process with China, Pakistan, Afghanistan, and the United States. We had 6 meetings, and similar initiatives have been taken, the Moscow format, and also China, Pakistan, and Afghanistan. There is interest of the regional powers, but I think here the leadership that must have come from the United States is not coming forward. We are disappointed that if there is confusion and then changes of American policy toward Afghanistan, then it will continue to be in the same situation that we find Afghanistan today.
Great. I'm sure there's a lot in that answer. I'm sure we'll return to in the Q&A and further discussion. Samir, back over to you. And I want to say to members of the panel, you should all feel free to sort of two-finger and respond to each other in this round. Samir, how are U.S. interests in Afghanistan, India, and Pakistan in tension with each other? And are these tensions solvable?
Yeah, I'm probably not going to give a satisfying answer to the second one, but I do think they are in tension. I think the U.S. has sort of 3 general properties to its grand strategy that are true historically and seem to be sort of manifest in the recent strategy documents that have come out in the national security strategy and the national defense strategy. And that is sort of some sort of general balancing of rising powers to ensure a balance of power in industrial Eurasia. some sort of commitment to nonproliferation. This is an argument that Frank Gavin makes that has historically always been part of U.S. grand strategy in the Cold War. And today you could say that's partly not just nonproliferation, but nuclear stability and nuclear security issues. And a third that I think is sort of manifest maybe in the last 15 years or so is clearly some sort of concern about violent non-state actors and the potential to hit the U.S. homeland. So these three things sort of seem to be a part of U.S. grand strategy writ large, and I think they play out a lot in this Southern Asia region. So, for example, clearly the United States sees India as a part of its balancing strategy vis-a-vis China, whether we sort of talk in explicit or implicit terms, that seems to be a part of the strategy. But building up India's conventional capabilities to balance China has a second-order effect of causing Pakistan to be deeply concerned about its conventional imbalance and leaning more heavily on not only on nuclear assets but on a nuclear doctrine that assumes a little more risk. And so that seems to sort of put in tension our balancing strategy with our nuclear security objectives. If we spend a lot more time investing with Pakistan on not only sort of general stability in the region, but also trying to sort of work with them on improving nuclear security and nuclear establishments, India sees this as a huge point of mistrust, and that undermines our ability to really build up sort of that trust that's necessary for India to become sort of this balancer vis-a-vis China. And then this third aspect of it, which is the Afghanistan project, I mean, ultimately we're talking about trying to build something of a strong, cohesive, stable Afghan state. But in a lot of ways, that can manifest itself in such a way that it is seen as threatening to Pakistan, as I think Rasul sort of points out. Like, there's certain elements of the nature of government and certain capabilities, it can actually be seen as threatening to Pakistan. It can also distract from U.S.'s objectives vis-a-vis India in terms of sort of bureaucratic and time trade-offs, as well as resources. So they all seem to sort of be working in tension with one another, and it's really hard to square the circle on this. I guess the only thing I would say in terms of a solution seems to be we have to, first of all, be honest about these trade-offs. I don't think we can sort of accept that we're going to have our cake and eat it too all the time. So there's going to be trade-offs. We have to accept them. We have to accept that there's going to be responses to the ordering of our strategy and then find second-best management strategies. And I think we have a history of that, and I can maybe elaborate on that later.
Anyone want to chime in on that?
So I'll just say, I mean, a lot of the issues that we've been talking about, kind of everything we mentioned, while we say kind of, you know, we think of these things as relatively new, each one of the issues, the trends we've talked about, has either existed before or is part of a long-running strain, whether it's kind of the China-Pakistan relationship, Russia's attempts to kind of get involved in the middle of trying to kind of balance India-Pakistan, the Afghanistan issue, et cetera. And it always reminds me of, for those of you who saw the show The Wire, one character says the game done changed, and the other one turns around and says, no, game's the same, it just got more fierce. And it's this intense...
Extra points for The Wire.
Slim reference. Charles.
Yes, it is Slim Charles. But it goes to show that, you know, when you ask, can this all be solved? It is the fact that some of it, I mean, one, we'll all be out of jobs if it was solved. So, you know, don't solve all of it at once for our kind of employment
I can find something else to do. I'm good. Honestly, if people want to, if world peace breaks out, I will find another career path. I'm good, just in case somebody has a solution and is keeping it secret for that.
But I think some of the things that we have to kind of go back, because if everybody is looking at these issues the same way, with the same assumptions. I'll take Afghanistan as the example, and Raul pointed it out. I mean, one of the issues we talk around is which Afghans, right? We always say, because each of the regional powers and extra-regional powers has their own version of which Afghans should own and lead. Mm-hmm. We also all have an idea of what that Afghanistan should look like. But the Afghans themselves, whether it's the one, whichever sets of groups that you talk about, have their own idea. Their idea of who is interfering is very different depending on who you're talking about. So unless we go back and actually have these conversations, and as Samir said, also the trade-offs, which is at some point, if you don't have common interests on some things, then admit that you don't have a shared interest or an end goal, rather than trying to imagine, for example, that India and Pakistan might have the same end goal, the U.S. and Pakistan might have the same end goal in Afghanistan, and actually work from back from the fact that you don't have common interests, rather than trying to pretend that we do.
That was great. And you have to follow it up with another great answer, Tanvi, because you're up next.
Can I
sure,
just
yeah,
jump
Dan,
in?
Go
Sorry, because you asked about tensions, and in the U.S. interests in the region. And I think to simplify a bit, it's the problem of the interconnectedness of these relationships that really brings our policies most often into tension. And back when I first worked in government, there was a lot of talk about de-hyphenation of India and Pakistan. That was one attempt to try and get U.S. policymakers to think about India on its own terms and think about Pakistan on its own terms. Yesterday at one of the panels, the point I think was made that then we fell into the pattern of a re-hyphenation, but a different hyphenation, Pakistan and Afghanistan. And again, I think we still live in this situation where we're thinking principally about Pakistan with respect to Afghanistan. Most U.S. policymakers first think about, I've got a big problem in Afghanistan. How can I then get Pakistan or my policy in Pakistan to begin to fix it? Now, I'm not saying that you can resolve that, but these interconnections, they are there. And even at the height of a de-hyphenation strategy, we didn't fully resolve it. But to be very acutely sensitive to what these interconnections mean to our policies. And I think the best point would be to try to avoid situations where we, that is the U.S., are paralyzed by the poor interrelationships of the countries in the region. That would be a starting point.
And you think that's where we are now? We're paralyzed?
I think we are bound up in it very tightly right now. Yeah.
Well, looking at things from India's perspective, you know, we talked about a few of the things we've talked about point to Indian-Sino competition sort of heating up. Is there a point at which this competition might lead India to conclude that its interests are better served by resolving its outstanding disputes with Pakistan rather than having this disgruntled, highly competitive, perhaps even aggressive China-friendly neighbor on its border?
So it's interesting, and what you're actually seeing, at least more recently, is actually the Beijing and Delhi trying to kind of lower temperatures on their side, both kind of recognizing that it had got quite heated in the last couple of years. There's been talk on the right in India in particular, amongst some, who have said, listen, you know, China's India's major strategic challenge, and one thing that India should do is kind of make peace with Pakistan. And that'll kind of take Pakistan out of the game. I mean, that assumes that Pakistan would go along. But there has been this discussion. I think one of the kind of intensification of trend lines that has happened that might actually make it harder today than it was even kind of 10 years ago is the kind of even deeper relationship between China and Pakistan. For all the talk about China-Pakistan relations, and, you know, these started in the 60s, that's not new. CPEC does kind of by any measure change the dynamics in some ways, because the first time you really see it was kind of too far away. They might be neighbors in one sense, but they're too far away countries that had engagements, but it was very high level. So you are having a much deeper, broader engagement, which has all sorts of dynamics, good and bad for all the three countries involved, kind of China, Pakistan, and India, but it changes the perception. And you can argue this either way, that on the one hand, for example, you know, familiarity might breed a little more kind of, if not contempt, concern in either Beijing or Islamabad or even Rawalpindi that make them change how they see India. And you saw this a little bit, for example, you've seen this a little bit in terms of changing equations with the recent financial action task force actions that China took. Or you can see from Delhi's perspective where it suddenly sees either an opportunity, which is rare, when you don't hear this discussed, but that potentially China can actually shape Pakistani decisions or stabilize it in a way. It's usually seen as CPEC is seen as threatening, but there is also this other aspect. There's also the aspect of seeing China kind of dragged down into all Pakistan's domestic political issues in a way. So I think there are ever-changing dynamics. There has been talk independently of China of, you know, getting the India-Pakistan economic relationship going, etc. But one thing we've seen over and over again with the India-Pakistan relationship is sometimes you have one side that's more eager to talk and the other side is not ready, and vice versa. So you have to have two people willing, irrespective of China, to say that this is something that is going to be a priority. And we haven't seen that really. It's been more kind of a let's manage it to a certain extent. But for the last few years, we haven't really seen any movement in terms of let's actually try to sort this out to take on this major strategic challenge. That could change, however.
Anyone else want to chime in there? Except Dan, because your question's related to this.
I'll wait for my question. Yeah.
All right, well, here it is. So what effect will this greater Chinese investment, CPEC, have on Pakistan's strategic outlook and perhaps even its strategic culture? Do you think this will make Pakistan feel more secure and as a product of that, more inward-looking, or more emboldened against India and locked in sort of this endless cycle of competition? Or is Chinese investment not even the right variable here in terms of however that turns out?
Yeah, this is for me one of the most interesting questions. So let's play it out a little bit more than you just did, just for the argument. If you see, say, CPEC works, right, in its most basic sense, that is, Chinese investments spur economic growth, and Pakistan sees a kind of a revitalization of its economy, what does a Pakistan like that want to do? One hopeful and optimistic view would be that it would do everything in its power to protect and defend that and not jeopardize the advances that it's made, to include kind of overtures, diplomatic overtures with India, that you would imagine that certain groups within Pakistan that are kind of on the fence right now in terms of their business and strategic interests with respect to India would begin to prioritize their business interests and their commercial opportunities. This is the positive vision that, of course, I think everybody would love to see. The problem is that the manner by which Pakistan is being reinforced by China doesn't necessarily take us in that direction, right? So we'd like to see that. But imagine a situation where Chinese investments are principally done behind closed doors in narrow ways that don't lead to a broader economic reform or growth package in Pakistan. So a Pakistan that continues to do somewhat better, enjoys the benefits of Chinese investment, but doesn't actually reform its economy or bring in other outside investors, including returning Pakistanis, their own investors, back to Pakistan. Imagine that world, where there you don't have the constituencies for peace that I just described, and you don't have necessarily the same opportunities or people looking for those opportunities with India. So then you get a Pakistan that may be more inward-looking, and you mentioned the word emboldened, the last point, a Pakistan that may, because it has China's backing, be actually more risk-prone in its dealings with India. Now, whether or not this is real or emergent as a reality, I can't say yet, but I can say that there are a number of Indians who are quite concerned about this, because when they look at what China is doing in Pakistan, they principally see it as China backing Pakistan to the hilt in ways that will make Pakistan more likely to jab India when it gets the chance. So that's the concern.
Would you like to comment?
Yes, I would like to say a few things. One is that CPEC is not really meant to reform the economy itself. The drivers of reforming Pakistan's economy are somewhere else, not in the CPEC program itself. It is a function of how Pakistan's fiscal policy, how Pakistan's trade policy, or investment policy, generally the economic policy of Pakistan is done. And also it is a function of our relationship with international institutions. Not that reforms have not been done. It is as a result of those reforms that Pakistan's economy is growing today at the rate of 5.6%. And the expectation is far more optimistic in the coming years and decades. And by one estimates, the Pakistan's economy at dollar parity rate is about 25th largest economy in the world. So reform are not going to be enacted into Pakistan's system, particularly the reforms is required within the national political environment. And I think there, China has no role at all. It is primarily the commitments that political parties, when they come to power, they make, but they have not been able to fulfill their own commitments. The structural economic reforms can be very painful for the consumers, and therefore, the unfortunate thing about this government, which lasted about 5 years, the second political government, is that it did not take critical structural economic decisions. That is privatization of public entities, which are eating up about 600 billion rupees each year. That's a huge amount. And also the privatization that they had committed and the crisis of energy, which is more about distribution rather than about production itself. So I think it's a very different thing. Second point that where I would like to humbly and very respectfully disagree with Dan is that it's not conceived as a narrow China-Pakistan highway where China will be bringing things to Pakistani market and taking its products to Middle Eastern countries, to African countries. You have to look at the broader vision of China's One Belt, One Road policy itself. It is simply one element, one wing that complements a much broader and much complex network, which United States and other countries have not been able to do it. It is a system that connects Iran, that is a system that brings in into Afghanistan and Pakistan and beyond that. And our vision is that it doesn't serve that purpose either. We would like to include Iran into it. Recently, there has been agreement that there will be a ferry service between Chabahar and Karachi and Gwadar, and Chabahar are going to be sister ports. For those who don't know a little bit of about the geography of the region, Chabahar is just 72 kilometers away from Gwadar. And the electricity is supplied to Gwadar and has been, not now, but for the last two decades, has been supplied from the Iranian grids. And we are going to continue more trade, energy trade with China. We would also like to include India into it. So it is, and the Gulf countries. So if that vision is not realized, the general objective that Pakistan has in mind of Pakistan's economic connectivity within the regional country will not really be realized. It is not, the objective is not to increase Pakistan's dependence on China, but rather to open up Pakistan to the Gulf region, to Central Asia, to Russia, and integrate all these countries. So I think we have to say that it is simply a very narrow and limited and not really open to other countries. There is no such framework. There is no such policy. And lastly, I think that that we should a little bit exclude this element from India-Pakistan rivalry. And if you look at the pattern, a historical pattern of rivalry between India and Pakistan, there have been good times, there have been bad times. And the problem of reconciliation or a kind of, not a cold peace, but real peace between two countries is very much dependent on domestic political factors and the kind of actors that seems to have emerged dominant in Indian foreign policy. And I don't see that as long as this government is there, and maybe that Modi and his advisors change their mind about Pakistan and the region when they win elections next time. But in Pakistan, we are also making transition, democratic transition, also elections. So therefore, leadership, statesmanship, and then the latent feelings of hostilities that exist between the two countries, they're there. But at the same time, I would see that there is a big change in both the countries. And in some constituencies, that peace and reconciliation and good relations between the two countries should be our future. If it has not been the destiny of our generations, we have to change that destiny. And Pakistan in no way depends on the strategic stalemate that it has been able to create on China. It's a very important strategic partner that we had, very reliable partner that we had. But again, to link all that pattern of strategic relationship to CPAC will be a little bit pushing the argument too far.
Great. I want to give Samir had a quick two-finger, and Dan, if you want to have a quick response, then we'll move on.
I just wanted to disagree on just a portion of what Rasul was saying about China's not really having a role in economic reforms. I agree that it's not directly trying to structure economic reforms in a lot of countries, but indirectly it can have effects on those in a variety of ways. So when you look at Chinese investments in other parts of South Asia, so I think of Sri Lanka in particular because I've spent some time looking at that case. The non-transparency of the investments, the injections of capital into sort of corrupt sort of side deals to sort of facilitate agreements to be signed, and the misdevelopments or sort of, you know, investments in things that don't necessarily have returns, and so you're saddling a country with debt. Those can also can forestall reforms rather than even if they're not sort of directly trying to structure them. And they can, you know, they create sort of political incentives for short-term capital injections, even if there are long-term debt problems. But the flip side, I think, is also that it's possible that Chinese investments in certain sectors can actually precipitate some reforms in a strange way. So there was this report that came out a little over a year ago on the larger plan for Chinese investments in Pakistan. And one of the sectors it talked about was in agriculture. And we know that agriculture in Pakistan is one of the more regressive, unreformed sort of aspects of the economy. It can be a huge drain at times, partly due to taxation rules and landholding sort of issues. And if the Chinese got into that and decided to sort of go into agribusiness, you could imagine a possibility where it could actually kickstart some greater efficiencies in that industry that might precipitate some reform. So I'm not saying that they're directly or that's the intention of the investments, but I think indirectly can have effects on it one way or another.
Dan, did you want to say anything?
Yeah, I'd just say, I think Rasul sketched out what I characterized as the kind of the rosy scenario for how China's investment in Pakistan could spark the kinds of economic growth opportunities and regional economic integration that I think many people would like to see. The challenge is, I think, related in part to some of the things that Samir just said and some of the things that I alluded to, which is that it's not necessarily taking us in that direction. And right now, I'd say we're still at the early stages, but some of the deeper concerns about the closed nature of what China is up to, the lack of transparency, the disconnect between Chinese investments and the broader reforms that Rasul rightly says this government in Pakistan has not undertaken, those are the challenges that I would put my finger on. And just this Samir's points about where we're seeing the Chinese kind of go wrong, these are the kinds of things that I think we have to worry about, not just in Sri Lanka or elsewhere, but in Pakistan as well. And it's a good cautionary tale to tell.
Back to Russia. You mentioned earlier that, you know, as far as the trade-offs on selling to both Pakistan and India, that so far Russia's doing a good job so far in managing those. How sustainable do you think that is if strategic competition does heat up in the region, also throwing in the fact that China buys a not inconsiderable amount of Russian arms?
Right. So Russia is always very happy to sell to all sides of a conflict if it possibly can. It's got a terrific model.
We've been too.
I'm not saying Russia's alone in that. But Russia has a great model for that with Azerbaijan and Armenia, where it's been very successful in making sure that everyone's buying its weapons. It's got real advantages, actually, for the combatants, because if you're managed to take control of the other guy's weaponry, you know how to use it. So, you know, I mean, just...
Everybody wins.
You know, I mean, really, it is. It's win-win.
Interoperability.
Yeah, exactly. If you manage to make side alliances, you could just jump right in. If you can turn some people and get a whole unit to defect, it's good. Anyway, so that's off topic. From a genuine strategic standpoint... I think we are in a period of realignment, and the Sino-Russian relationship is not guaranteed going forward into the future any more than any other relationship is. It's not an alliance. That isn't to say that there aren't real alignments between the two countries and they aren't pursuing similar goals. But you can see, for instance, because Russia does have its sights set on greater influence around the world, that as it becomes more successful, say in East Asia, It begins to develop relationships that make it harder to maintain such a close, friendly relationship with China. And that could have an impact on how it looks at China and South Asia as well. And the extent to which Russia's relationship with Pakistan is partly facilitated by its relationship with China, this could be interesting. However, as China's own relationship with Pakistan evolves, that, you know, it's all of these moving parts all at once. I think, for Russia, if it looks just as at India and Pakistan, then, okay, just be very careful to make sure the things you do don't get the other guys too angry. Maybe try to talk them down when they do seem to be getting angry. It's manageable. You throw everything else in, it's still manageable in the near term, but in the long term, there's a lot of room for wild cards.
Great. Tanvi, you wanted to chime in there?
Well, just, I think, you know, doubling down on Olga's point about kind of the interconnectedness, this is a web. This is not, I mean, there are so many links now that even, for example, I'm not sure it's feasible to say that you can take something like India-Pakistan out of all this, or kind of an India-China out of this, or China-Pakistan, because it is also interrelated. Whether kind of, you know, Russia's kind of positioning in Afghanistan, which used to be a lot more similar to India's, for example, is now much closer to China's and Pakistan's, perhaps, partly related to how they feel about the U.S. India is concerned about kind of Russian actions. Is also concerned that the U.S. is pushing Russia to China. And this has implications for U.S.-India relations. Kara Abercrombie is in the room. She had a great piece on kind of the interconnectedness of the U.S.-Russia-India piece, but also what implications this has for the U.S. policy vis-a-vis India and China. So I think it is, we are in a world where you pull one thread and everything starts to kind of hopefully not unravel, but it is all connected to those other threads. And this is what makes it more complex, but also speaks to the point that having such discussions where we cross over kind of these regional lines that we have built because our bureaus or organizational kind of institutional bureaus are set up that way, this is a challenge for us in policy terms about even thinking about these issues, let alone operationalizing them.
Sure.
And you know, the other set of countries you've only briefly alluded to is the Central Asian countries, which also have gone through some shifts in their attitudes towards Pakistan and India, which also have are very involved in China's Belt and Road Initiative projects. They're hoping that ties them in further. They're hoping that that's going to give them economic gains. They're facing the same trade-offs and constraints and problems that Pakistan is in that context. And it's not necessarily guaranteed that where they go is where Russia goes or vice versa.
Mm. Can I just Dan, sure.
I think we run the risk, though, we talk about interconnectedness, Tanvi. It's undoubtedly correct that all of these things are interconnected and probably more so than in some sense they ever have been because of the communications technologies and transportation technologies, everything pull everyone closer together. And this region in particular is getting hotter in this way, as Samir has pointed out in the Southern Discomfort series. But interconnectedness should not lead us to, I think, this kind of sense of, well, it's all very complicated. I think we have to pull back and ask some prioritization questions. And for Olga, I guess I'd frame it more as a question than an answer, but what little I've started to understand about Russia is it seems like Russia is, its prioritization is its concerns about us and the West. And in some ways, because of that, it becomes paralyzed in terms of its response, say, to China in Central Asia. And many of its other activities seem to be opportunistic, but principally with its focus on us rather than on, say, India for India's sake, or Pakistan for Pakistan's sake. I wonder if that.
So I think it's not inaccurate to describe it that way, but it's a little. It depends. Russia has some parts of the world and some issues on which it knows its interests. They're clear interests. It's pursuing those interests. One of those interests is a broad desire to be globally more influential, and that is a thing in and of itself. Now, when Russia thinks about ways to maintain and guarantee its great power status into the future, it looks to the U.S. and NATO as a threat to that, and also a yardstick and a way to kind of measure how capable it is, which creates a certain amount of attention on the United States, specifically as it develops policies. But that isn't to say that it doesn't have its own interests. And it isn't to say that its alignments, for instance, with China, are purely driven by the United States. They look at the world and they see things in much the same way. So, for instance, take, you know, getting out of this region a little bit, Russia's not in Syria because of the United States. Russia's in Syria for a number of reasons. The United States is part of that equation, but Russia's mainly in Syria because it was concerned about the future of stability in Syria, and it didn't want to see another autarch get overthrown. Let's put it this way. Now, the United States was backing the overthrowers, so the United States still plays here, but it wasn't initially and specifically about the United States. There's just this confluence of all the things there.
I'd like to, final question, and then we'll open up to Q&A. Kind of an uncomfortable question for Rasul about Afghanistan. And full cards on the table, I used to work in Afghanistan as a DOD civilian a number of years ago in Helmand province. And so I have my own opinions on that conflict. And don't take what I'm about to say as me saying this doesn't also apply to the United States. I won't for a moment defend much of America's Afghanistan policy. Pakistan has publicly supported the idea of talks between the Taliban and the Afghan government for a number of years, and it doesn't seem like we've had any real progress so far. But it seems like one of the fundamental problems that Pakistan's dealing with in Afghanistan, and this builds off Tanvi's remark earlier about which Afghans, is Pakistan has a severe trust deficit among the various factions that are internal to the Afghan conflict. A lot of that distrust among the current government in Afghanistan stems from the fact that Pakistan has supported and sheltered the Taliban for a number of years now. But Pakistan also has that same trust deficit with the Taliban because that relationship hasn't always been a comfortable one. So do you think it's important for Pakistan to be able to overcome that in order to see real meaningful talks that lead to an actual settlement in Afghanistan? Or do you think that's a secondary problem that we're just going to have to manage through?
I think it is a primary problem. I don't think that it is a secondary problem. The trust, the confidence. Without that trust and confidence, you cannot even sit around and enter some meaningful dialogue. But then this trust deficit is not among all these elements that you have mentioned in Pakistan, but this trust deficit also exists among different factions within Afghanistan itself. And the elements that you have mentioned, those and the government of Afghanistan, it is all around. And that trust deficit also exists between Afghan government and the United States government, Pakistan and the U.S. government. So the objective should be how to then make all these different actors reconcile. There need to be a three-tier, in my view, reconciliation process. It must begin where I think there appears to be a collective failing, including Pakistan itself. But then U.S. and other powers are also equally responsible that we must have worked from the very beginning how to bring these Afghan factions, ethnic, religious, regional, together. Without that national reconciliation, you cannot create one Afghan nation, one Afghan state, one Afghan country. It will remain fragmented. There is a history of decentralization, autonomous control, warlordism, and the state historically has been weak. The state and this periphery and this conflict would continue, and you will create that relationship of proxies and external patterns. We must work at this fundamental level of Afghan reconciliation. The second one is, I think the regional reconciliation is extremely important. At least Afghanistan should not become a strategic playground for India and Pakistan, which have been rivals. It should not be a strategic background for Russia, for Iran, for all other countries. If Afghan reconciliation process does not move forward, all these countries will find favorites and proxies inside Afghanistan. Last but not the least, I think it is very important. Let us bring China, Russia, and the United States together. The Quadrilateral Forum excluded Russia. And then Russia made its own moves and convened a meeting of other countries. Let's not create all those parallel structures are bringing about reconciliation. They will only promote proxyism, voyeurism, and conflict. We do think that we have a trust deficit, and it is our level, and I don't think that is an excuse. We need to work very hard. Otherwise, I don't think that there can be any positive leverage that Pakistan can exercise, or you can exercise, or any other power can exercise.
Olga?
I'm just going to jump in. I've also spent some time working on Afghanistan. And the one thing that always comes to my mind when people talk about reconciliation is how you can have reconciliation when you never had conciliation. I mean, you're talking about creating something that isn't part, not just of the recent history of the country, but going back for a very long time. And to bring it back to how the Russians, and I would also argue the Central Asian countries view Afghanistan, they don't have a pie-in-the-sky notion, by and large, that it's all going to fit together nicely under a centralized government. They understand that, you know, the best-case scenario is a certain amount of stabilization, but also a certain amount of warlordism, and that you want to get it to a place where it's stable and controlled rather than this notion. I mean, the Soviets tried it, right? They also, their initial vision was, you know, kind of, you know, back when they went in, that you would have a communist government, it would all fit together. And, you know, it took them a decade to figure out that that wasn't working. It's taking the United States longer. But I think, you know, when we talk about Afghanistan's future, and if when we talk about other countries' involvement, whether it's because they're the ones who are elbowing their way in or it's because different factions are pulling them in for their benefit, there are a variety of perspectives. And I think we've discussed this, that people come to the table with different interests and we should accept that they have different interests. Some of them might be more realistic than others. I'll just leave it there.
Thanks for listening to War on the Rocks. Don't forget to rate us on iTunes. It makes a difference. And check out our membership program at warontherocks.com/subscribe, where you can go deeper than the articles.